record. Over to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's hard to see you, so I might have to do a bit of this. So it's really lovely to be here with you all on Parinirvana Day. In my talk today, as Narayanji has said, I'm going to be touching on themes to do with loss and grief and death. And it's okay to be upset about that. If you're upset and you want to stay in the room, that's fine. If you're upset and you want to leave the room, that's fine. There aren't any rules about how you should respond to a day like today. So just look after yourselves and give yourself what you need. So the title of this talk is Be a Lamp Unto Yourself. As the Buddha lay dying, gazing back at his disciples, he gave them an exhortation. Of all the things the Buddha could have said on his deathbed, he chose to say, Appa Dipo Bhava, be a light unto yourself. I've reflected on why the Buddha chose these words, chose this teaching. Out of all the words he spoke in his lifetime, this is what he chose to impart to his disciples and us at the very end of his life. I think in a way he's saying, you don't need me. You have the teachings and you have your own capacity for enlightenment. You can be a light unto yourself, and in doing so, you can be a light for others. I think that's a really encouraging thought. There is no talk of heaven or of meeting again in the next life. Just this, be a light unto yourself. So as we sit here today on the Buddha's Parinirvana, I think it's really important to reflect on his final words. Until recently, I volunteered as a Buddhist chaplain at St. Peter's Hospice. I wanted to make myself available to witness those final journeys, to hear those precious final words. I think I'd imagined before I commenced the role that having a profound and lengthy conversation with patients about where they found meaning in order to hear their stories and to understand what they believed happened next, if anything. What I was not prepared for was the reality that death, for many people, comes much, much sooner than they or we imagine, and in forms that seem impossible to prepare for. Those existential reflections and conversations that we imagine we might have will inevitably be eclipsed by the imperatives of pain relief, the routine of the hospital or hospice, and our own stark terror of death. And that's if we're lucky enough to die not to die suddenly and without any possibility of farewells or preparation. So I don't know about you, but I live my life as though I have all the time in the world. Despite practicing the Dharma for 33 years, despite a long career of being confronted with the worst forms of human suffering, and despite a stint as a hospice chaplain, I consistently and willfully turn away from the utter certainty of my own inevitable death. And of course, it's not just my own death that I turn away from. It's the truth of the nature of existence, the very fact of impermanence, the proof of which I see everywhere, not least in my own body. Death is just the final dissolution, the trump card of impermanence. There is nothing lasting anywhere. Even when we look at ourselves, we have to acknowledge that we are aging and passing, but still we hang on, we turn our faces away. The other parting words of the Buddha were, all things are impermanent, with mindfulness strive on. So deep is our denial of impermanence that the Buddha sought to remind us on his deathbed one last time that this is the ultimate truth, that all things will fade away. So as I say this to you, I imagine some of you may be feeling some fear, and I feel fear when I say those words. It's not my intention to frighten you, and I certainly don't feel doom-ridden. But what I want to talk about is what I call the Great Project, which is how we practice within a context of certain death at any time, and how we can best prepare ourselves for that. Reflecting on impermanence and death is therefore very important indeed, not least because it helps to break down our innate tendency to over-identify with our bodies and to construct a fixed and lasting and permanent idea of self. I guess the big message from my talk today is don't leave it too late. We can fantasize about retirement and a time in the future when we're going to have all the time in the world for deep reflection, but that is by no means certain. What life offers us every moment of every day is the opportunity to strengthen that muscle of embracing death as no less a part of life than birth, no less precious, no less an opportunity for profound insight. Life offers us up sights to wake us up. The Buddha's sights were old age, sickness, death, and the wandering sage, and for so many of us, the sights will be the same. These are moments when the reality will penetrate our denial, when something we take for granted will shatter irrevocably. The loss of a loved one, a life-altering illness or accident, a terminal illness, and if we're lucky enough, the march of old age, when we look in the mirror and no longer recognise the person staring back at us. For me, the first experience of death came when I was 30. My beloved granddad died of lung cancer. I remember arriving on the ward and seeing granddad sitting up in his bed by the window. We handed him a potted daffodil as the weak February sunshine struggled through the window. It was the first time in weeks the sun had appeared. The daffodil was not yet in bloom. It was waiting to burst its beauty onto the world. All its potential held in abeyance, awaiting its perfect moment of blossoming. My granddad placed the daffodil on the window beside him and said, "That will outlive me." And his words dropped into me like a stone. He was joking, surely. The thought came to me, how can a daffodil outlive my granddad? He was solid, lasting, he was permanent. He was as dependable and perennial as the earth. The daffodil bulb, with its impending bloom, was ephemeral. Its destiny was to live vividly and briefly. This was the first moment on that ward in Westminster Hospital, surrounded by so much life and purpose, with oxygen cylinders and nurses, that the thought came to me that he might be dying. My instinct was to run away, just run and take death with me. I would take death away from him, and when I returned, I would have boxed it up and weighed it down with chains and thrown it in the Thames. I could not imagine a world without him in it. And yet, for weeks he'd been coughing up large clots of blood and lung. He would say that when he lay down, he felt like he was drowning. He was in a hospital attached to an oxygen mask. Which part of all of that had escaped my attention? 4 years beforehand, they cut away half his face to remove the tumour that had turned up like an unwanted visitor at his retirement. For the preceding year, he'd been faithfully attending the Brompton Hospital for his radium treatment, as he called it. In my 13-year-old brain, none of that added up to imminent death, final Christmas, last weeks. I felt like Dorothy desperately watching the sand fall through the hourglass. I was both panic-stricken and numb, wanting to be far away and wanting to climb in his bed and be enveloped by his huge hands, which were the size of spades. When we came back a few days later, Grandad was in his bed attached to an oxygen machine with a mask over his face. His eyes were wide and darting around the room, as though he was searching for an escape hatch. He looked really afraid. I was stood at the foot of his bed, and the room was sticky with grief. I remember that my granddad fixed me with his gaze. He took off his mask and he said to me, Will you be okay? Of course, being so would become my life's work. 2 days later, he died on St. David's Day, and eventually I imagined that they would come and remove his body. I imagined the cleaners taking away the sheets from his bed and washing down the plastic cover on the mattress. They would remove what was left of him, this man I had loved all my life. His belongings, the book he was reading, his glasses and his hearing aid would all be put into a plastic bag. The cleaner would make up a new bed and walk away with all of his stuff in a bag, probably chatting to her colleague about taking her lunch break. And in my mind, the sun comes pouring onto the ward as the daffodil finally opens itself to the world. Of course, even though I have this deep, seemingly unshakable belief in my own solidity and permanence, I am just like the daffodil, with a destiny to live vividly and briefly. This is my mum next to me. She died in April last year. One day we were chatting, and the next day her heart stopped. They tried to revive her, and miraculously they did so. But due to a lack of oxygen to her brain, she never recovered consciousness. We had to make a decision to withdraw life-sustaining care and all fluids. She took 3 days to die, and we sat with her around the clock, playing her beloved Bach through my iPhone, reminding her that we loved her, holding her hand and saying goodbye to her. My mum's ashes, as you see, are on the shrine beside me. As she lay dying, I looked at her over and over again, and I kept thinking, I lived inside that body for 9 months. When we decanted her ashes last week into the wooden urn, I saw some of her ashes slip through my fingers, and I thought to myself, these ashes are all that remain of the mother in whose body I lived for 9 months. So life offers us up opportunities to see how things really are. 10 years ago, I woke up as usual for work and took a shower. In the middle of showering, my legs gave way and I collapsed. I couldn't feel my legs at all. I was taken to hospital in an ambulance, and I experienced a kind of hell over the next few days as I waited and waited for surgery with no idea what was going to happen to me. I was in surgery for 8 hours. Spinal surgery requires a deep anesthesia because even a micro movement during surgery can be life-altering. It was clear when I came home that the injury I had suffered and the delay in surgery meant that I would have an incomplete spinal injury for the rest of my life. I can walk on crutches, I use a wheelchair, and I'm in pain most of the time. The impact that using crutches has on my arms and hips is devastating, but sitting for long periods in a wheelchair can be really painful too. I will never recover, and as I age, I will need to spend more and more time in a wheelchair and need greater and greater levels of personal care. When I had my spinal injury, I had a career I absolutely loved. I'd worked for the probation service for 26 years at that point, and it was like family to me. I had a very senior role which allowed me to be really creative and to work with the most extraordinary team of brilliant and committed people. Probation was where I felt I belonged. You know, people repeat the platitude, it's not what you do, it's not who you are, it's what you do. But in my case, they were completely mistaken. My work was a massive part of who I was and how I expressed my going for refuge and myself in the world. It was the reflection of my deepest values, that no one is defined by their worst moment, and that we can all change with support and care and the right conditions. It was how I expressed my love for the world. So when I came home, I faced a huge challenge of how I was going to carry on with my old life. I decided to go back to work, even though my wheelchair would not fit in the office door and I couldn't use the toilets. even though I was in so much pain by the end of the day that I was asleep and on heavy painkillers at 7 o'clock. I was simply unable to let go of my old self. I had my spinal injury in December 2014, and I eventually accepted reality and took medical retirement in April 2021. So I'm not telling you this to give you any impression that there was any virtue in battling on for those 7 years. I'm trying to explain the lengths a person will go to when they are bargaining against a death and a loss that has already happened. When I came round from surgery in December 2014, the person I had been had died. She died on that operating table. It took me 7 years to finally acknowledge that, and I'm still not really able to grieve the loss. And of course, it didn't just happen to me. My beautiful husband, who's here today, is here too, and it happened to him, and I would have been utterly lost without his support. Our old life died that day too. It was like someone dropped a grenade and blew everything up. So what my injury did was it completely shocked me out of my deeply held view and expectation that my life would by and large continue much as it had, and that I would continue much as I had, albeit getting older. What my injury did was it completely disrupted my fundamental sense of myself. I still describe myself as an able-bodied person trapped in a disabled body. I'm still surprised when I see my reflection in my wheelchair. I take a moment before I realise that it's me, and I still feel shocked at that. Not being able to feel parts of your body or make them respond to your commands is completely disorientating, and it totally undermines your sense of control and self-efficacy. When asked to describe what it feels like, I say it's like a dream I had, where I was standing on a beach and watching a tsunami coming towards me. I know in the dream that I can't outrun it, so I'm forced to wait there and for my fate. In the dream, I know that this tsunami is all the grief that I have failed to feel about my spinal injury and all the integration work that I still need to do around it, and I know with certainty that it will engulf me. Of course, I know that this is where we all are. It's also where you are. We are all waiting for sickness, old age, and death, and none of us knows when that wave will crash or how. But reflecting on that isn't what necessarily helps me. It scares me a little bit. What does help me is knowing that all the views I have about myself have actually just gone. The able-bodied version of myself, the runner, the cyclist, the girl who used to run on the beach with her dog, and the girl who never had to ask for help. She's gone forever, and she's never coming back. All I have left of the memories of that, and the reality of how things are for me now. And what I find in that is a deep and profound sorrow. And it's a sorrow that not just that this is how things are for me, but this is how things are for all beings, for all life. We are all disappearing, and everyone and everything we love is disappearing. Kukai says, "You too are like the sun going down behind the western mountains, and thinking of this, my heart feels torn." And I know exactly how that feels. I know the taste of that, as I'm sure do many of you. But what I also want to talk about is the freedom in that. It is all changing all the time, and some of it is just bloody awful, and we wish it was so different. But in the midst of all of that impermanence and change, there is something else, an incredibly precious jewel sewn into the hem of my robe that I had no idea was there, and that jewel is freedom. I am fluid, I am in flux, and that means I am also free of the past. I'm free of the ideas I have about the present and all that the future beckons for me. So one of the really grim aspects of living with a spinal injury is how my altered sense of self also plays out in my interactions with others. My experience is that my spinal injury and the paraphernalia of crutches and wheelchairs also has a profound effect on other people. I'm like the sight of sickness manifesting in the world, and I can see how much people can struggle to respond to that. So I have an overwhelming sense that I'm no longer here, at least not in any way that I really recognise. So this sense of self breaking down can also be mirrored in how people respond to me. I no longer recognise myself in this new form, and clearly some people don't either. So what I realise is that death, I'm really going to have to let go of who I think I am. Having a spinal injury and ageing too, I think, it forces us to start that process of letting go. The form simply cannot hold. So within this practice of trying to turn towards death of self, I have an experience of not being able to hold on to myself or others, whilst also trying to reach for a point of liberation within all of that, which is of course really difficult. There is a scene in the first Harry Potter film where Harry stands in front of a mirror called the Mirror of Erised. The mirror shows whoever stands in front of it what they most deeply long for. A friend recently asked me when we were watching the film what I would see if I stood in front of the mirror, and I simply answered, myself running on a beach with my dog. So practice for me now is how to live richly and fully without a debilitating sense of lack, whilst holding on to the truth that I have lost myself somewhere along the way. Practice for me means loving really deeply and unflinchingly whilst trying not to cling, embracing and letting go all at the same time. When I was in spinal rehab, they told us that we needed to perform a funeral for ourselves. They asked us to get a shoebox and place items in it that represented our old life. Running trainers, pictures of ourselves as we were, anything that related to the person that we used to be. We were asked to bury the box or burn it, a funeral ritual for the person that had died. I was not able to do it, and I have still not done so. I still struggle to look at pictures of myself as I was, and I still behave as though I'm an able-bodied person. I will often turn up at a venue and forget to ask about access, because in my head, I'm not disabled. I put my body through all manner of rigours, because in my head, I'm not disabled. Of course, I am sitting here in a wheelchair. I no longer do the job that I loved, and there are 100 things that happen every week that remind me that I have changed forever. The girl I was is never coming back, and I cannot find her no matter how hard I try. The form cannot hold. Life offers us up opportunities to see how things really are. Aging will do this too, but in a slower and less dramatic way. The shock of a life-changing injury is like the shock of death. Someone died, and it was me. And of course, that's what loss does to all of us. It blows our life up. It disrupts our fundamental illusion of security. I cling to what I love. People, my pet, my career, even my body. I cling. And in that clinging, I create a fantasy of something lasting, something permanent, something unchanging. It's not the loving that hurts us, it's the clinging that undoes us. So yes, life offers us up an opportunity to wake up. When we die, we will have to let go of our bodies. So better start now, I think. I read the following poem at my mum's funeral, and it is a daily teaching to me. I want to be like the maples, letting go so easily of their leaves in the slightest autumn breeze, surrendering every piece of themselves they no longer need, and embracing bareness like a new suit they can simply step into. But I'm more like the beech trees, which cling to the husks of their leaves long into spring, refusing to give up even a scrap of who they once were until the last possible moment. Perhaps they need the reassurance, or maybe they're here to lend music to the silence of winter, leaves beaten thin as tissue paper, rustling a lonely chorus in the snow-covered woods, until buds push up to the surface, and with no other choice, they say yes to the final scatter and release, seeing again, as if for the first time, how loss leaves room for something new. So this is the great project for me, this daily practice of preparing for the certainty of my own death and the death of those I love, whilst reminding me that the hour of that death cannot be known. I could die in the car on the way home or not wake up tomorrow morning. However, what's really important to me is to make that practice a thing of beauty, a leaning in to what it means to be truly alive. Thich Nhat Hanh writes, "Impermanence is more than an idea. It is a practice to help us touch reality. We have to nourish our insight into impermanence every day. If we do, we will live more deeply, suffer less, and enjoy life more. Living deeply, we will touch the foundation of reality. Touching impermanence deeply, we touch the world beyond permanence and impermanence. We touch the ground of being and see that which we have called being and non-being are just notions. Nothing is ever lost, nothing is ever gained." The Diamond Sutra too reminds us that all conditioned existence must be viewed like a tiny drop of dew or a bubble floating in a stream, like a flash of lightning in a summer cloud or a flickering lamp, an illusion, a phantom, a dream. These are the reflections that I try and recollect each day, and what I'm trying to communicate is the beauty and freedom in that. But just to be clear, I would be the last person to try and put a positive spin on loss. I'm absolutely not denying the utter, gut-wrenching, life-shattering agony of losing a loved one, getting a terminal illness, having a life-changing injury. These experiences are catastrophic. They can crush us. And yet, as Rukmini Rea writes, "There is a brokenness out of which comes the unbroken, a shatteredness out of which blooms the unshatterable. There is a sorrow beyond all grief that leads to joy, and a fragility out of whose depths strength emerges. There is a hollow space too vast for words through which we pass with each loss, out of whose darkness we are sanctioned into being. There is a cry deeper than all sound, whose serrated edges cut the heart as we break open to the place inside which is unbreakable and whole, and learning to sing." One of the things that I feel often as a result of my own losses is that I'm not alone. Loss is a unifying experience. We will all lose everything eventually. And that gives me a profound sense that I am no less or more a part of this great pulsing longing of life to which we all belong. Loss finds its way eventually into the form and fills us up in an entirely new and often unexpected shape. So I turn towards the inevitability of my own loss and death. And in my effort to be well prepared, I worked in a hospice. I have written my will. I have set my affairs in order and drawn up my own funeral service. I have also turned towards my regrets and the things and people I have not been able to forgive. I do not want to end my life knowing that there is unfinished business. I have forgiven and continue to forgive some deep hurts. And it's really hard because I am not integrated, and there are parts of me that have no interest whatsoever in forgiveness, parts of me that don't believe in it, and which wish to honour and hold tight to old wounds. But when I recollect my granddad at the end of his life, all he had were words of love. There's no room at the end for anger, so why not give it up now? I realised some years ago, when I cut off contact with some important people in my life, that the next thing that would happen in that story was a funeral, mine or theirs. And I thought to myself, is this how I want to end my days? Do I not long to be free of the pain of not forgiving? Can I not give myself that blessing and liberation? So a part of this practice is allowing ourselves to be fluid enough to also let go of old hurts, to let go of those we love, to let go of our bodies and ourselves. And one of the simplest and most transformative practices of turning towards impermanence and letting go is meditation. When we meditate, we bring attention to our breath. The breath is a constant reminder of the passage of time, of the constancy of change and flux. As we close our eyes to briefly focus on our breath, we rest in the knowledge that at this moment, we are truly alive. We are really here. As we show some curiosity for this next breath and this next breath, we can breathe in the beauty of impermanence, that everything can change. Of course, the deeper reflection is that meditation shows us how to let go. We can let go of wondering about what happens after this talk, what we'll have for dinner, or deeper fears for ourselves and our loved ones. And as we see into the moment-to-moment sensation of the breath, that everything passes, we can give up on the desire to cling to our experience. Because if everything is impermanent, then we don't need to cling to it. It makes no sense to cling to it. And if it makes no sense to cling to our experience, then we can simply let go. We can let go of our experience. We can let go of ourself. And when we do that, when we really let go into this beautiful, precious, never to be had again moment, the world is suddenly fuller, more exquisite, and our experience is radiant with the luminous beauty of this precious moment when we were truly and really alive. And I make it sound as though that's the easiest thing in the world. And I know it's hard, and I know it can be agony, but letting go can also be profoundly liberating. Consciously using meditation as a vehicle for letting go and seeing the impermanence of all experience helps me to build a muscle in this area. If I can let go of my grief and see and feel it as a fleeting phenomenon, then maybe I can let go of my old self and eventually let go of who I think I am and still long to be. And when that happens, however fleetingly, the truth is that I'm more alive than I've ever been, because the only place I can ever really be alive is right now, right here. Lama Gedrum Rinpoche writes, "Happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower, but is already here, right now, in meditation and letting go. Don't strain yourself. There's nothing to do. Whatever arises in the mind has no importance at all, because it has no reality whatsoever. Don't become attached to it. Don't pass judgment. Let the game happen on its own, emerging and falling back without changing anything. And all will vanish and begin again anew without end. Only our searching for happiness prevents us from seeing it. It's like a rainbow which you run after without ever catching it. Although it does not exist, it has always been here and accompanies us every instant. Don't believe in the reality of good and bad experiences. They too are like rainbows. Wanting to grasp the ungraspable, you exhaust yourself in vain. As soon as you relax this grasping, there is space, open, inviting, and comfortable. So make use of it. Everything is already yours. Search no more. Do not go into the inextricable jungle looking for the elephant who is already sitting quietly at home. Nothing to do, nothing to force, nothing to want, and everything happening by itself. So being a lamp unto myself means carrying the knowledge and impermanence of my own death with me at all times, so that I can let that knowing feed my life. I want to know about it every day as a necessity and as an indication that the fabric of compassion is stitched into the universe itself. This is not about living a detached and disconnected life. Mary Oliver says, to live in this world, you must be able to do three things. To love what is mortal. To hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends upon it. And when the time comes, to let it go. Let it go. So may you all be a lamp unto yourselves, and may you all rest in the grace of the Buddhas and be free.